Intelligence is defined as the collection of valuable information. But who defines this information? Who determines its value? At GeoOwl, we redefine intelligence through our people, through teamwork, through innovation, and through expertise in GeoInt, SIGINT, HUMINT, and analysis. We believe intelligence is more than information. It's critical decisions, it's our mission, and it's a commitment to our customers. We provide a new way of thinking, a new path to success. GeoOwl, the new era of intelligence.
Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. I have a special episode for this week's podcast. My guest is Nick Smith, and he is an Army veteran, and he does some fascinating work that he's done in the service of the government and things that he's doing now with his company, GeoOwl. Nick, how's it going?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I remember, I don't remember the year. I don't remember if it was like 2017 or 2018 when I first sort of became aware of GeoOwl. And then I was talking to someone, a mutual friend or a mutual associate. I don't know what your relationship is with that person, but we were talking about something and they were like, yeah, those GeoOwl people, like, they're legit. And I was like, oh, okay. And that's kind of how I ended up like following you guys and stuff like that.
Cool. Awesome. Well, I'm always glad to hear that people are talking well about my company. I started the company in 2013. And what we do is we provide geospatial technology solutions and services to the special operations community and the intelligence community. So it's really great to hear that, you know, people are liking what we're doing as geospatial intelligence experts. So that's great to hear.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw, there was a Joe Rogan clip. I forget who he was talking to. Maybe Tim Dillon.
Tim Dillon. Yeah, I know the clip very well.
Yeah, I don't know how old it is, but I saw it like somewhat recently in the last like month or so, and they were completely like shocked by, you know, what is this geospatial intelligence agency? Like, what is this? And it was just kind of funny. And when I saw it, I did think of GeoOwl, which I found kind of funny. But okay, so let's talk about your time in the Army.
Yeah, no, that's great. And that clip, I actually have it posted on my Instagram and stuff like that, because it's so funny. Yeah. You know, they learn about geospatial intelligence and NGA, and so that's really great. So I was in the Army for 7 years. I did 4 years active duty and then 3 years in the reserves. And, you know, I was deployed to Iraq as a satellite imagery analyst. And what's interesting is when I initially went to join the military at 18 years old, I go through MEPS, which is just the processing station, and go to choose my MOS. I go talk to the administrator, and she gives me a list of jobs. And she points to some of them and she says, what about this one? You look at satellites. And as an 18-year-old kid, I was thinking, yeah, well, I want to look at satellites. I want to work with satellites. That's awesome. So I selected this job, which was 96 Delta, imagery analyst. And lo and behold, it has nothing to do with looking at satellites. That's absolutely not what we do as imagery analysts, which are now called geospatial analysts. But you get to do something a lot cooler, in my opinion, which is work with the variety of sensors that are hosted on satellites and work with the data coming off of those sensors to build actionable intelligence. And that to me was when I actually learned about what it really is. I was shocked. I was like, huh, I thought I was working on satellites. But it became evident that it was way more interesting to be building the intelligence picture and telling an intelligence story to decision makers and watching the impact that type of analysis can have.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really fascinating sort of area. Okay, so you did that for a couple of years. Is that the you held that job throughout your entire time in the Army?
Yeah. So, like I said, it was the 96 Delta, which was satellite imagery analyst. Somewhere along the way, they switched it to geospatial analyst. But yes, I was an imagery analyst the whole time. I was also airborne, so that was fun and almost kind of pointless for an intel person. And I'm sure a lot of the intel people will say the same thing. You know, what am I going to do? I'm going to jump in with my laptop and do some satellite imagery analysis somewhere. Didn't quite make sense, but it did make sense from the point of view of being a tactical intelligence person. What that means is, you know, you are ready to go anywhere in the world. You are ready to be hand in glove with the intelligence operations where they're happening in the world. And that's something I've continued today as the CEO of GeoWow. You know, our entire company is built on this idea of being tactically relevant. So we will go and deploy with the special operators. We'll be in the operation center. We're the guy in the chair, right? That we're putting the pieces together. We're identifying the right assets to use. You know, so we're relied upon heavily to be there with them, and that's kind of our bread and butter, so to speak. That's what we do really well. Is, you know, we provide that tactical intelligence. So yeah, the whole time in the Army, I was a imagery analyst. I got out in 2006 from active duty, and I went to the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and I got a high speed degree in psychology. Now I had a top secret clearance, and I thought, you know, with this degree in psychology, maybe I'll be able to get a job here, right? This degree in psychology and a top secret clearance, I'm golden, right? Well, I couldn't get a job to save my life. And so I was thought maybe the FBI or something. So I applied to all these things. I didn't get anywhere. And eventually went back to Florida and worked with my brother on a professional mixed martial arts promotion. So like the UFC sort of. We did 16 professional events throughout the state. We had a national TV show, all that good stuff. It was a lot of fun. But eventually the well of sponsors dried up when all these poker companies, they were helping to bankroll it. Something happened with those poker companies. If you remember back in the day, Full Tilt Poker, Poker Stars, these kind of massive companies formed over online poker, and they went belly up because they did something illegal. The FBI busted them. I'm not exactly sure. It had something to do with banking. I think they were kind of running their own banking system. But anyways, that dried up. So I had to stop doing that and find a real job, I should say. And I went and worked for a big defense contractor as a project manager for a really high visibility national security intelligence mission. And that's kind of how I went from the military to getting back into working in the intelligence space. I worked at that company for about 4 years and did some really awesome things. Worked at some of the national agencies, three-letter agencies that we all know and love. And then after that, started GeoWow in 2013 and have been supporting the special operations and intelligence community and the military writ large ever since.
Okay, so, you know, that the operations that are run by a sort of kinetic force or even an intelligence mm-hmm. operation, all of these things are able to happen because of good information. And there's so much information that can be gleaned from satellite imagery and things like that. A couple of weeks ago, I came across some information that I wanted to include in an article that I'm working on. I mean, by the time this goes out, the article will probably be up. But it required being able to verify the information by looking at satellite imagery. And I kind of went down the rabbit hole of like learning how to identify locations through looking at satellite imagery. I mean, I'm in no way, shape, or form like any kind of expert on it, but it's such a fascinating practice, if you will, because there are so many actual cases of, I mean, aside from like the sort of real serious, you know, classified work that is done at the level that you're at, but just in terms of like proving that people are committing war crimes or things like that, that there's so much that can be done in that area, and it's very fascinating stuff.
Yeah, so that's, you bring up a really cool point about the geospatial industry, the geospatial market as a whole. So I always say that the geospatial market, when I say geospatial, I'm talking about things like, it includes things like doing imagery analysis. We can talk more about what geospatial is as a whole. But the geospatial market is a horizontal market. It doesn't apply to one market vertical. You can apply this type of intelligence to anything from elite intelligence operations around the globe to working with farmers and identifying where they should be fertilizing. This type of intelligence is extremely powerful. Retailers can use it to identify where they should locate their next branch. I could go on and on with the number of use cases. John Deere just did a massive investment into satellite companies. Why? Because they see the future, right? They understand that the intelligence that you can derive from these types of sensors is basically limitless. Now, for their instance, they want to use it for working with their farmers and helping them out, you know, gain the most crop yields and that sort of thing. But that's just what I'm talking about. You know, we can talk about the use case for predicting military occupations. And well before the invasion of Ukraine, there were imagery analysts raising the flag saying, hey, I can see a very similar buildup here on the border of Ukraine to what happened in 2014 when they invaded Crimea. Right? So we could tell from looking at the imagery that the Russian forces were building up on the border of Ukraine, and they were starting to send in units like mortuary units and these types of things that, you know, tell you it's much more than a training exercise. The Russian doctrine's pretty clear, and it looked a lot like it did in 2014. So this was predicted well before it ever happened. We knew 7 months before they ever even stepped foot in Ukraine. But that's just the power of geospatial. You know, geospatial intelligence can provide those types of predictions. And like I said, it's horizontal from military to healthcare. Look at the coronavirus. This was another massive use case for geospatial intelligence. Everyone's probably seen that Johns Hopkins dashboard. It was used on almost every single news network as a way to identify where the cases were surging. And that type of geospatial intelligence in the healthcare space is super interesting. It's awesome, right? We can look at where diseases are occurring. We can see what types of effects weather has on disease. We can see overlay different layers and compare those with the data. So it's really a great space, and I'm happy to talk about all of it.
Yeah, one of the things that I do outside of here is I do OSINT investigations, like open source intelligence and sure. Investigations. So, but I do it primarily for articles that I would publish. You know, looking at different, you know, websites that provide satellite imagery, one thing I noticed is there's a ton of options that are specifically for, you know, looking at weather patterns, like changes in the weather, or like being able to look at water in a different way. So it's so many different things that it's used for, and it's really remarkable. And then, you know, somewhat recently, there was a big issue about the Chinese sending a balloon over the United States.
Yes.
And, I mean, obviously, that's a problem. But, you know, they can look at sensitive sites just using satellites.
Okay. Let's talk about this balloon, because it's a massive problem.
Right.
Recently, and it's come out through, I think, NBC News or one of those national news sources, that they were actually able to collect ELINT, which is electronic intelligence. You know, all of our weapon systems put out an electronic signal, and you can gather those through sensors and things like that. Now, the excuse for letting the balloon fly across the country that was put out was, well, yeah, they can collect this stuff from low Earth orbit satellites, so it's really not a big deal that, you know, they fly a balloon over our territory. But I heavily disagree with this. Anything that you collect from a low Earth orbit satellite, you can collect times 10 from a balloon. Why? Because it's lower and the resolution is going to be better. You know, the data accuracy is going to be better when you're flying at a lower altitude. So this idea that we should just let a Chinese government fly a balloon across our country and that's okay because they have satellites is total rubbish. Because I know what we can do with our balloons. And let's assume that they have the same capability. They don't. But let's assume they do. We should never allow this. This can't be allowed in our country. We can't allow a country to fly an intelligence asset across the United States. That cannot happen. It's such a failure. I could probably sit here and rant about this all day. As an intelligence person, understanding the capabilities of a stratospheric balloon. So balloons are interesting in the ISR space, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, because they fill some interesting gaps, right? If you look at a stratospheric balloon, again, the resolution is going to be better on any sensor, whether that's an imagery sensor, whether that's a signals intelligence sensor, an ELINT sensor in this case, the resolution of that data is going to be better than a satellite. The dwell time, in other words, how long it can stay in the air, is going to be a lot longer than, let's say, a manned aircraft or even an unmanned aircraft, because it's not relying on fuel. So they do have some downfalls. They're very difficult to control. You're essentially steering them with the winds. it's not a heavily relied upon intelligence source just yet. But if you just take a second and assume that the Chinese can collect on us the way we can collect on them, then you know that this was just a massive failure of national security. And now they know they can just fly over our country and we won't do anything because of optics or something. I don't know. But yeah. It was a crazy time, wasn't it? People were like, yeah. What is this thing? You know, in Montana, you had all these pictures going out, people shooting at it and things like that. The Air Force was escorting it and trying to jam it and things like that. But that's a lot of, you're talking about spending a lot of money to, you know, jam a balloon that we could easily shoot down. So anyways, I could go on about the spy balloon, but as an intelligence professional, I can tell you that, I was scratching my head the whole time as I was, and I was watching it fly. You know, you could go online and see the maps of where it was at and things like that. I was just scratching my head. Like, why are we allowing this to happen? We can't shoot it down over somewhere with no people. And anyways.
Yeah. Cause it was kind of strange because, if I can recall correctly, I think they knew about it before it was over, like, you know, Montana and sort of the mainland, which is kind of strange. But and then, you know, you're right, like in terms of it can collect a bit more and a bit better. When I was looking through different satellite platforms, like satellite imagery platforms, mm-hmm. and you look on certain dates, you know, some dates that, you know, there's more clouds than others, so you can't see the ground, you know. Right. And like you said, there's only a limited time that a satellite may be looking over a certain area. So, you know, those are, that's something that I've sort of realized just doing my very limited search, you know, through satellite imagery.
Yeah, and while, you know, we do have ways of seeing through clouds, believe it or not. It's not necessarily seeing, but, you know, things like gathering SIGINT data, signals intelligence data, we can certainly do that through the clouds. You can certainly collect ELINT data. And of course, as a imagery analyst, I'll tell you, for a long time, we've relied on synthetic aperture radar. And you're actually seeing SAR, as it's called, used a lot more in the commercial space. You're seeing commercial satellite companies pop up left and right with new use cases for SAR. So it's essentially, it's an old technology, but the resolution gets better and better and better. And, you know, with all these new computer vision models and things like that, we can really use SAR to for a lot of different use cases. But from a intelligence collection aspect, you can absolutely locate units, equipment, all that stuff super easy through SAR. You can even tell what's a decoy and what's not. So SAR is great at looking at an object and saying, is this an inflatable balloon or is this really an aircraft, right? And they'll even try to foreign militaries will put up deflectors on to, because they know about what synthetic aperture radar can do. Essentially, all it's doing is it's sending radio waves. That's it. And it's bouncing those radio waves back to a sensor and collecting it. But we do have ways of seeing through clouds. So letting an asset kind of sit over our country isn't cool. And of course, the Chinese, they have low Earth orbit satellites as well. And they just steal our technology. So they have SAR too. They probably stole it a long time ago.
Yeah, they steal a bunch of technology. And I think not just from the U.S. I think they steal from everybody pretty much.
China's stealing technology is not just something that happens for China. Stealing technology is their entire strategy.
Yeah.
Right? You could invest billions and billions of dollars into research and development, or you could just steal it. And that's their strategy. It's like, why? And of course they do R&D as well, but why waste billions of your own dollars doing R&D when you can simply send in a spy to a university who has access to that R&D, make copies of it, and send it back to China. And if you don't think that that's happening, then you should probably pay attention to what's going on in our universities.
Yeah.
You know, every single STEM opening right now in our universities is filled by someone with a Chinese name. Why do you think that is? Do you think that that's an accident? There's just so many people that are Chinese that they happen to be filling those roles. Certainly not all of them are spies. It's not what I'm saying, but you can't tell me that none of them are, you know?
Right.
So if you sit and you think about China, and you look at what they've done, you got to realize that they are public enemy number one, in the intelligence space. They have capacity, they have capability, they have reach, they have things that, and assets that, have the absolute capability of doing massive harm to the United States. We just saw the hearings on TikTok, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a sticky situation because TikTok has 150 million users in the United States, and TikTok is a business. No business that I know of is going to risk losing 150 million users. Who knows what the revenues are? In order to hand information over to a foreign government like China. China obviously owns, there's a Chinese company, ByteDance, which owns TikTok. They have the capability upon request to access data at TikTok. Now, according to those hearings in Congress, this hasn't happened yet, but they could do it. And of course, the argument the other way is, well, you know, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, they're all collecting data on the users. I don't see what the big deal is. But we're really in for an interesting time here with China because they want to access our market, right? The United States is the largest commercial market in the world. Of course, they want to access our market, and we want to access theirs. But if we're going to not allow Chinese companies like TikTok, like DJI, who's the leading drone manufacturer on planet Earth, there's going to be a fight at some point, right? Because we're going to say, well, we want to access the Chinese market, but we're not going to allow any of your companies to access ours. It's just it's a hairy situation. And, you know, as an intelligence person, you know, I like to think critically about these things. And I don't like to predict the future because I don't think anyone can predict the future. But I do see a debacle ahead of us in the next 10 years, if not sooner.
In terms of like an actual conflict or...
I don't know if there needs to be a conflict, right? Economic warfare might be the actual version of World War III, you know? But cutting off access to the U.S. market, you see China meeting with Russia and Iran. You know, these things don't look great. And if they're looking to be the world superpower by 2050, which is absolutely what they're trying to do, there's going to be some type of conflict, and I'm not saying it's going to be warfare. It's inevitable. Unless we get our act together, unless we really have some strong leadership, we take action where it makes sense, like not letting them fly a flipping balloon across our country. We do need to walk tall and carry a big stick. And it just seems like we're not doing that more recently. And I don't get into the politics of blaming this president versus that president. There's been failures across the board in multiple administrations for allowing China to grow as large and as powerful as it is. But it's almost just inevitable to see the conflict on the horizon, right? At some point, it's going to reach a breaking point where they're going to say, hey, the United States, this isn't fair. You're not allowing us to access your market. Every time we have a successful business, you're banning it from the United States. So if that's the route we're going, we just we have to be smart about it. And, you know, unfortunately, I think that's going to be the center of conflict is based around market access.
Yeah, and it's such a fascinating dynamic with China because they've essentially grown, you know, powerful and influential in many ways on the backs of the United States through, you know, U.S. investments into China or you know, big companies going into the Chinese market. And then they, as you illustrated, they sort of turn around and just steal a bunch of, you know, technology and stuff and... You know, they have, you know, vast networks that are connected to the Chinese intelligence service of where they, in particular, they go into schools, I mean, across the world, really, not just in the U.S. And they steal information. At my company, where we focus on articles using OSINT techniques, we uncovered a on LinkedIn a Chinese ads for they were recruiting postdoctoral researchers in the U.S. To work in like STEM fields. So it's really interesting to see their sort of networks, you know, working towards, you know, trying to get the best and brightest to, you know, do research for them or remain in the U.S., do research in the U.S. and give them the information. So it's really interesting to see the way they do this. And then when confronted, like, you know, the situation with the balloon, it sends relations, you know, down in the dump. So it's really kind of interesting the way they operate.
Yeah. And, I think from an American perspective, we think about things in the short term and they don't, right? Xi Jinping, however you say his name, he's going to be there forever, right? He's going to be the guy for the next 50 years or whatever. He doesn't need to think about next quarter or next election cycle. He's thinking about this in terms of the next 20, 30 years. So, you know, when we see these little things happening, oh, there's a, you know, university here hired a Chinese person. Oh, China's grabbing, you know, this little bit of land over here. Oh, they're buying farmland in the United States. Oh, they've stole this little piece of software here. Those little cuts add up. I mean, it's literally death by a thousand cuts when it comes to China, because they're just doing things everywhere, and they're not taking huge steps, right? They're not invading Taiwan with a massive military. They could soon. I hope they don't, but they could. But they're doing everything other than large scale military action to circumvent the United States, and across the board. They're just our adversary, you know. And if we can't admit that at this point, it's almost crazy to think about.
Yeah, I think it's become more apparent now. Like there are several bills in Congress. Both sides are supporting it in efforts to counter China. They've done some stuff with semiconductors, the CHIPS Act. So for the audience, the semiconductors are in every, you know, piece of technology we have, computers, phones, everything, advanced military equipment. But the supply chain for it is, it's not a single country that makes everything. Parts are made in Japan or in the Netherlands. Most of the, or all of the designs for the advanced chips come from the United States, and they're, most of the advanced chips are built in Taiwan. With the CHIPS Act, there were some investments are being made by the government to build some of these facilities in the U.S. To where they can build some of these semiconductors. So what they've done is they, and you're probably aware of this, but they've banned, they put export controls on some of this, the ability for China to get some of these advanced chips, and Japan, I think the Netherlands signed on as well. So there, I don't know, it was in the end of last year, within a couple of days, I mean, they cost like China billions and billions of dollars, in revenue, cause they essentially, they told any American working in China on any of these semiconductors, like if you have to leave or I think it's the penalty is they revoke their passports or something like that. So like within a day, they killed that industry. Now I think China is doing some things to get around that. So it's interesting now because, you know, for, I don't know, 40 years or 50 years or a little bit longer, U.S. president after U.S. president, you know, the idea was, well, once China modernizes a bit, you know, they'll become more democratic and more like us or whatever. And meanwhile, right. Yeah, right, that didn't work. So meanwhile, the Chinese would purposefully, like, you know, keep that thought going, knowing that they weren't going to do that. And U.S. visitors, you know, state visitors would go to China and they would have a very planned out sort of tour. And they would hide a lot of what they really felt and thought from U.S., you know, visitors. And so in one hand, they sort of fooled us to a point. And now they're obviously very strong and powerful and influential. But it's interesting to see how it's going to play out, because now there will be some U.S. resistance to what China does. So I'm interested to see, you know, how much they grow and how much they continue to do things with actual U.S. resistance.
Do you think that that CHIPS Act that you talked about, does that make it more or less likely that they would want to invade Taiwan?
You know, that's a good question, because so here's the thing, right? If they do invade, you know, would the Taiwanese destroy the factory, or would the U.S. even destroy the factory? Or so it's like, if they do invade, it would potentially really crash the world market. So it's so hard to say. I'm really not sure, to be honest.
Yeah, that's one of those situations where there's no winner.
Yeah,
there's no, like, because even China wouldn't necessarily win, right? They get their quote unquote land back that they say is their land. But like you said, we're not just going to let them have our semiconductors, right? It's something's happening to those factories. All the more reason to just, you know, not let it get there in the first place, and
yeah,
show strength in the South Pacific Sea. And, you know, Don't let them walk all over us. That's my opinion. But it gets a little sticky when you're talking about these companies like TikTok, like DJI. DJI, for example, is very interesting. You know, when drones first started being a thing, they were absolutely crushing it, and they still are, by the way. DJI is the leading manufacturer of drones in the world. And at my company, at GOL, we do a lot of UAS collection, unmanned aerial systems collection. So we go out, in addition to the intelligence support and military support, we also support engineers. So we'll go out and collect pieces of land and do like a topographic map with LIDAR, right? So we can use LIDAR, which is light detecting and ranging. It sends out a light, essentially a beam of light to the ground, and it returns. It's the active sensor. And each return can be mapped out as a point. And when you get enough points, when you get millions and billions of points, you can create a point cloud, and that's how you build 3D features. Anyways, so we can do this type of 3D mapping. And we've tried a bunch of different systems. And the most expensive systems are only marginally better than the commercially available DJI systems, which are much more affordable. I mean, you can buy a LIDAR sensor now for $10,000. That's really advanced, that you can fly from a drone. Phones, I know, like the iPhone has a LIDAR sensor in it. It's not as good as those aerial ones used for mapping. But DJI is just way ahead of the United States commercially in this space, right? It's not even close. We'd have to be another 10 years before we catch up, because there's no company in the United States that can manufacture the amount and to the same standard that DJI can. So, I mean, it's just an example of how sticky this whole China situation is. They're making good stuff, right? And now you're starting to see states, I think Tennessee just passed a bill that doesn't allow DJI drones to be used in state projects.
Hmm.
I imagine that's going to be across the board. Every state, every red state especially, is going to be doing this. The federal government already does this. The federal government, through the Defense Innovation Unit, puts out a list. It's called the Blue UAS list. And on that list are drones that the federal government allows for use on federal government projects. And of course, DJI is not on there. So you can't use a DJI drone for a federal government project, but you can buy a really expensive Canadian drone. You can buy a super expensive drone from a manufacturer like Skydio, which is actually an American company, but they don't have the capability that DJI does. So it's like damned if you do, damned if you don't sort of thing. And I think it's just a good illustration for how sticky this China situation is, because the companies like DJI are making better technology. TikTok is making better technology. TikTok is absolutely eating Facebook's lunch, right? Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, all these social media apps, Twitter, they pale in comparison to what TikTok is doing right now. TikTok has 150 million users in the United States. And on top of that, they have grasped the minds of our kids.
Mm-hmm.
You look at, I had a middle school coach on my podcast not too long ago. We talked about the Super Bowl, right? I'm a football fan, so I decided to do one about football. In addition, usually I talk about geospatial intelligence, of course. But in any event, we were talking about football, and he's a coach at a middle school here. Actually, he's the athletic director, but he's in addition, he coaches the football team. And he told me that being immersed in with youth today, at every single break that the kids get in middle school, they're on TikTok. They're scrolling the TikTok feed. They're doing the dances. Everything is running through TikTok. Yesterday, my wife was out for a walk, and she ran into a friend, and the friend had a 3-year-old child in a stroller that was on TikTok. Now, nothing against that friend. Probably not the best choice as a parent to allow a 3-year-old access to TikTok.
Yeah.
but the point is that, you know, this technology, like TikTok, like DJI, which has access to the U.S. market, puts us in a really wild situation where we need to make a choice between better technology or better security. So that's the choice. You know, do we want to have better technology, or do we want to have better security? And it's obviously, a company like TikTok would never, ever admit to handing over data to the Chinese government, or else they would lose 150 million users. So it's a wild time to be looking at these countries and this technology.
Yeah, I didn't know that they banned DJI drones from like government projects, because I'm also a photographer, and I've traveled quite a bit, and I've owned several DJI drones, like Phantoms and Mavericks and stuff.
They're great.
So, yeah.
I had our UAS lead. Her name's Carrie Mapes. I had her on my podcast not too long ago, and she talked about her favorite drones, and they're all DJI. You know, the Mavic, the Air. They just make better drones. I mean, it is what it is. Now, the Blue UAS list is for federal government, right? So not all of the states have bought onto this yet. I imagine they will. But, for state projects, city projects, you're probably okay. Probably not too reliable as a long-term option.
Well, what's the name of your podcast for the audience if they want to check it out?
Oh, yeah. It's just The NDS Show. That's my initials, The NDS Show. It's on YouTube. I've started it in November. I've done about 10 episodes. We'll have 11 and 12 coming out here soon. And the whole idea behind the reason why I really started the podcast is, one, it's fun. I'm a busy guy. You know, I have multiple businesses and things like that. But I like these the opportunity to talk to people like you that are smart and have interesting takes on the world. But even more so, I get this question all the time about, Nick, what the hell do you do? Like, people that have known me for years, like, I'm talking 20 years, they'll be like, Nick, I still don't understand what you do. I'm like, well, let me explain it. And I explain it, and they still don't get it. If I say I make maps, they get that. But that's not what we do, right? I mean, it's kind of, you know, we do, of course, make maps in addition to a lot of other things. But I just find that there's this massive misconception about what geospatial is, what geospatial intelligence is, what the intelligence community does, what the government does. And this entire concept of exposing the reality of what's happening in the intelligence community, exposing the reality of what's happening with geographic information systems, drones, AI, the, you know, emerging tech, things like that. It's fascinating to me. And that's why I started the podcast, is to talk about those things. And I could hopefully answer those questions for people when they ask, Nick, what the hell do you do? I can say, well, just watch this episode. You'll get it. You'll get it or you won't.
Yeah.
But more so, I imagine that a lot of people have that question, right? They don't, you probably have never heard the word geospatial before. You know, if you're 20 something and you, you're going to college, maybe you'll see a course or something like that and be like, huh, what's that? Well, my hope is that, you know, with my podcast, people can learn about it and say, oh, that's cool. I want to do that as a career, or I want to learn more about this field, because we just need, we need great people, and across the board. I just think it's important to spread the word about what this cool stuff is that I've been fortunate enough to do for the last two decades.
So can you sort of like just walk through exactly the, the different sort of facets of GeoOwl and like some of the services you guys, or capabilities that you guys have?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll start with the easy stuff, and then we'll go into the hard stuff. So we do provide services. So these services are service contracts with the Department of Defense, with the Special Operations Command, with the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, with the United States Army. And these services are, generally speaking, geospatial intelligence services. We know what good imagery analysts look like. We know what good geospatial intelligence analysts look like. So we'll hire them, and we'll staff positions inside operation centers for, let's say, military intelligence units, or for the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, right? Because we're intelligence people, you know, we have a center of excellence in our company that is all focused on training and developing these types of skills. So that's the easy stuff, right? We hire people to do this type of work. Another segment of our business is production. So we have entire teams that build digital cartographic products. So things like the underlying foundation and all the maps that the federal government uses, right? The data that is below everything. We're the ones that build that type of framework. Or should I say help build that type of framework, because it's a massive undertaking. We work on projects like the multinational global co-production program, which includes 36 different countries, and we're all mapping the world, right? We're building out data in a schema that is readable and understandable across different use cases. So that's essentially the mapping bones, if you were, for all other agencies to use to build more intricate, detailed, and accurate maps. Having an accurate map is super crucial. And then the third segment of our business is we build technology. So we have software developers, and we build intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance software. One piece of software is called Pattern Flows. And what Pattern Flows does is it makes the process of intelligence easy. A lot of times in the government and in the military, the systems are very antiquated, as we all know, right? Like it takes a long time to get software into classified networks. So the government doesn't just work on the internet that we all know and love, right? We call that the NIPRNet, N-I-P-R, NIPRNet. That's the green internet that we can all access. The government has multiple networks. One is called CIPRNet, which is the secret network. So if you have a secret clearance, you can, and you have the need to know, you can access CIPRNet. And then there's another network called JWIX, which is the top secret internet, right? This is where all the top secret stuff is. And of course you need all the requisite security clearances. So because it's so difficult to get software from a commercial standpoint onto these networks, a lot of times the software is antiquated, and it's not like when you go home and you're flipping through Netflix or Apple TV or Amazon, and they have these nice, beautiful user interfaces and things just kind of work the way they should. Well, that's based off of years of research that these companies have done and years of use cases and feedback and stuff like that. A lot of times in the government, the software is just, it's just old. It's just old. Like you would expect that same level of, you know, user experience, user interface design, that sort of thing. But that's not really the case. So anyways, so what Pattern Flows does is we've built a modern user experience, a modern user interface to do intelligence work, and it just makes it easy. So what it enables you to do is collect different types of intelligence. You talked about open source intelligence, which is a really fascinating area. It's exploding right now, and I'm happy to talk about OSINT. I absolutely love what's happening with OSINT right now. But what it does is it enables you to collect on a map, and it really illustrates how important that spatial data is. And when you're performing intelligence collection on a map or linking in with data sources via API, and they're flowing through on a map, it enables you to do some spatial analysis, you know, things like determining, you know, where clusters of activity are occurring. And we've just built it out to be so simple that, you know, an Army private could do it, or, you know, an Air Force, you know, E4 could easily learn this very quickly. And then of course it's distributed via the API or via like the web in a way that's really easy to consume and really easy to understand. So we've built it to be kind of like the Netflix of intelligence. And it's supposed to just be easy. And that's the way we've built it out. And if you look at other intelligence software in the space, it's just not. It's very complex. There's menus within menus within menus. Anybody that works in the intelligence will tell you how complicated the software is. But it doesn't have to be that way. So anyways, so GWAL, essentially those three segments of our business, services, solutions, and technology, all focused on geospatial. And our mission is to empower everyone on Earth with geospatial technologies. That's our mission. So it absolutely falls in line with what I'm doing with the podcast and things like that, because I really would like people to understand how this technology can better their lives and provide better solutions, better answers for really hard decisions. So did I answer the question? Did I answer the mail about what GWAL does?
Before we continue, I'd like to talk to you about this week's sponsor, Four Patriots. Drought, inflation, and even new policies are pushing America's food supply near its breaking point. That's why survival food is more important than ever. Create your own stockpile of the best-selling Four Patriot survival food kits. It's not ordinary food. We're talking good for 25 years survival food. Handpicked right in a family-owned facility in the USA and giving jobs to over 200 Americans. The kits are compact, sturdy, water-resistant, and stack easily. They have different delicious breakfast, lunch, and dinners. You can make these meals in less than 20 minutes. Just add boiling water, simmer, and serve. And right now, you can go to 4patriots.com and use the code RECON to get 10% off your first purchase on anything in the store, including this 3-month survival kit. You'll get their famous guarantee for an entire year after your order, plus free shipping on orders over $97. They're called 4 Patriots because a portion of every sale is donated to charities who support our veterans and their families. Just go to 4patriots.com and use the code RECON to get 10% off. That's 4patriots.com. Use the code RECON. Start building your own stockpile today. I still don't know what you guys do. No, I'm joking. No, you did.
Love it.
So do you guys primarily work with the government in terms of, like, you know, contracts and things like that? Or, like, or have you worked with, like, you know, we spoke about it a little bit before, like, you know, there's a ton of sort of human rights things that can be done with, you know, geospatial intelligence.
Sure. Yeah. So we do primarily work with the military, with special operations and intelligence community. But we've done work for the United Nations. We've done work with, like, wildlife. We have a project with the North Carolina Department of Transportation where we map out where the red cockaded woodpecker's at. You know, so we go out and mark the nests and put those on a map, and you can build analytics off those things. But like I talked about, we also support engineers and things like that. The humanitarian case is very interesting. You know. It's a great use for geospatial intelligence. Like, you know, I talked about earlier about how we can identify how Russia, you know, was going to invade Ukraine because things looked similar to before. Well, that same philosophy occurs when you're looking at data and talking about things like civil unrest or migrations from, you know, refugees and things like that. We can see those things in the data. So it's a great use case. Some of the work that we did with the United Nations, the United Nations is a crazy organization if you think about it, because what you're asked to do is work with Russia and some of these other countries, and they do have an intelligence use case, right? What we did with them was working on a country in Africa, and they were curious to know where all of these vehicle carcasses are at. So they wanted to know if we could identify vehicle carcasses. Don't ask me why, because I still today don't know why. But we went through a bunch of data and identified, you know, hundreds of thousands of vehicles that are derelict on the side of the road, rusted out, you know, don't work. And we gave that data to them. But, you know, there's a number of use cases. Like I said, it is a horizontal market. You can apply it to anything. You know, we could build maps for where a dentist should open their next dental office. I mean, it's limitless what you can do with this stuff.
So you mentioned OSINT. I did a podcast. I recorded it a couple of weeks ago, but I published it a few days ago with a guy who was at the CIA for, you know, over three decades. And he has a book out, and in the book he speaks about the different ints, you know, OSINT, SIGINT, HUMINT, GEOINT. And, you know, from his perspective, he's talking about, you know, combining everything to get a picture. You know, from what I do with my company, StrikeSource, we only do OSINT, right? And when we sort of do group investigations on certain things, like, we have some folks there who are, like, very good at it, you know, worked for the government for years, and now they're doing this, you know, with all that experience. And then, you know, having these deep dives on a particular topic or subject, we see where the limitations are for open source, right? It's like, if we wanted to learn more, we need, like, we need signals, we need, like, satellite imagery. So do you guys ever do anything outside of geospatial, or?
Yeah. So in order to be a contractor for cleared programs, you have to have what's called a top secret facility clearance. So what that enables us to do is hire cleared individuals and hold their clearances and things like that. So we do a number of different projects that are just straight up SIGINT. You know, it's SIGINT reporting. We do some projects that are security. You know, my philosophy on intelligence is this, that every single, that p- people get assigned to an int, right? Whether that's in the military or you go work for an agency or something like that. The great analysts really know a lot about all the other ints, because like you're talking about, an OSIN is almost not even an int. It's really a combination of a million different ints, and you're working with OSIN, you know, open source data. But in order to be a great analyst, you have to understand, let's say as a GUINT person, I have to understand the human process. I have to understand that, because if I'm flying an, if I'm controlling an asset over a certain area and we're working with the human team, we're waiting for something to happen on the ground, I need to understand, you know, what that might look like. I need to understand what information I can get from, let's say, a human operator who's running sources and things like that, so I know what to look for. Same thing with SIGINT. You know, a lot of times, you know, if we're, let's say, looking for a certain cell phone registration, well, it's very unlikely to just, you know, point a camera somewhere and see someone, oh, there's the person on the phone. You have to understand that, at least a level two knowledge of SIGINT is that everything has an ellipse, right? They don't collect anything that's a perfect pinpoint. There's always a margin of error in everything they collect. So you have to have this knowledge of the other ints, and you have to understand the data, in order to build a really, really good picture. And at the CIA, for example, you know, they have, their officers are, you know, they build an all source picture, you know, a lot of them, they have a bunch of different types of officers, of course, but, they're just a good example of an agency that does understand all the ints. And, whenever they're making these big decisions, they don't just rely on one, you know, they look at multiple, sources, multiple methods. And, that's how you build a good intelligence picture. That's how you tell a good story. You know, when, back in the day when I was giving briefings and things like that to, you know, these high level government decision makers, I'm not on the ops floor anymore. I run a company now, so I don't get to do this fun stuff. I would never just tell a story about what we saw. Like that would be part of the story, right? That would be an important component of the story, but it's not the whole story. You know, what you really want to do is tell a story built with different viewpoints, different perspectives. You want to try to disprove your story if you can. You know we're right because we looked at this and this wasn't there, or you know, we went and talked to the SIGINT people and you know, the data is congruent with what we were seeing here, and we talked with the human people and they agreed. So intelligence is all about building a cohesive picture across the ints, and in the GUINT space, a great GUINT analyst is really an all source analyst. They understand the data from any source or method. And what's great about OSINT is that, like I said, OSINT it's really a misnomer because, you know, it's not an intelligence type. Like GUINT, you're working with spatial data, right? You're working with location data. SIGINT, you're working with electronic data or communications data, right? So, you know, things like cell phone registrations. HUMINT, you're working with humans, pretty obvious. But OSINT, you're working with anything that exists and is available on the internet. Like that's not a type of intelligence. It's a source of data. But it is still really neat. And OSINT is great because a good OSINT person is going to understand all of that, right? They're going to understand, hey, I read this in the news and I saw this thing on Twitter and I saw this on Telegram, and they all kind of marry up, and you know, they're going to understand that underlying data and put these pieces together. So yeah, I love this stuff so much. I could talk about OSINT all day. We do some OSINT at my company as well. Probably not to the level that you guys are doing it. But it's still a really cool area. And in my opinion, the future of the intelligence community is not all, but it's shifting to be more open source, to be more commercially unclassified, things like that. And then we'll plug those gaps where we don't know things with classified sources. In my opinion, that's where it's moving. It's an unclassified intelligence space, and we can use all this awesome open source data through all the awesome technology that's happening on Nippernet or the commercial internet. And then we can build our intelligence picture and fill those gaps with classified means. So it's a great time to be in the intelligence space.
Yeah, with the, you know, the more that people are on the internet, right? Like the war in Ukraine, you know, guys who are on the front lines are online talking about some of the things that are happening. You know, groups in occupied Russian areas in Ukraine are giving, you know, updates on what's happening. Like it's really right. Crazy. So it's like, from an OSINT perspective, even if someone's not publishing information or whatever, it's horrible that there's a war happening and a ton of people are dying and, you know, all that. But just from an OSINT standpoint, it's really fascinating to sort of practice your craft in a way and just monitor channels and see what's happening and verify information and stuff like that. So. And that's kind of how I, you know, like I've known about like GEOINT and geospatial, intelligence. But then I've had some information sort of cross my desk where, I wanted to verify it. And in order to do that, I needed to look at, satellite imagery. Mm-hmm. And then I went down a rabbit hole. I read a couple articles on like how to identify, looking at satellite imagery, like, all these different things, and
can you say what it was that you were looking for, and like what your approach was to that?
Yeah. So, well, by the time this comes out, the article will be published, so it is fine. So, I was looking at Crimea, and so Russia is building like physical defenses in Crimea. So, I was using information that I got, and looking for specific things like specific defenses or like there was a video that was posted of this person drove past this some sort of like barrier that was built in Crimea and then shortly after the barrier there's a road sign it's in Ukrainian and so then I was able to sort of pause the video, enhance that part, and then look, you know, try and find it through the information from the road sign and then looking at satellites to try and actually see the barrier that was built. Part of the issue is, I guess, from a if you're not working for the government and like you don't have a business centered around this, is like good satellite imagery is expensive, you know? So I kind of ran into that.
Very expensive. Let me help you out though, because there was a company that just started not too long ago. It's called SkyFi, SkyFi. It allows you to task a satellite from your phone a couple hundred bucks. So I would try that first, if they have coverage of that. I don't know if they have all the deals yet with Planet and Maxar, these massive commercial satellite imagery vendors. But I would try SkyFi because you can do it for, you know, a couple hundred bucks and you'll get your image. And it's actually great because you just touched on one of the largest problems in the GEOINT space, which is the data is super expensive. It's crazy expensive. I mean, obviously these companies that launch satellites, it takes what, 10 years to launch a satellite. It's super expensive. You know, the R&D that goes into it, building these sensors and it's just an insanely expensive process across the board. So of course the data, right, which is what they're selling, which is how they make their money, is going to be expensive. there are some free imagery sources that you can use. The resolution won't be as good.
Yeah.
You know, NASA obviously works with USGS on what's called a Landsat program. And you can get low resolution imagery from that, and it's free. The next generation Landsat Next imagery, Landsat Next will be a 3-satellite constellation, and you'll essentially have, I think every 6 days, they'll have the entire Earth mapped out. Again, the resolution might not be up to the level of a commercial satellite, but it'll still be freely available data, and that's good. So you touched on a real problem in our space right now, is getting the price of this data down to the point where you can actually use it to do these types of investigations that you're doing. So that's really neat. Were you able to find what you were looking for, or was there another way you could verify it?
Yeah, so I was able to verify, but not through just looking at satellite. And it kind of annoyed, that part kind of annoyed me, because I wanted to do it just looking at the images. And so I found a company that like you have to sort of apply, and they take a look at you, and then they decide if they're going to accept you or not. So I just like wrote them an email saying, hey, I'm a journalist, and this is what I do, and they accepted me, but I'm not fully up to speed on exactly how to utilize the system yet. So I need a little more time on actually using it, but the way it works is like they have different levels of image quality, and obviously the highest levels are more expensive. Yeah. But it's just tricky, because it's like I don't want to pay for something that I'm not sure I can see what I'm looking for. You know, I don't want to spend $200 and not get what I want.
Yeah.
So, you know, I might have to just try it out anyway. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But on my part, I was able to verify some of the locations because I happen to have contacts in Ukraine. But I was hoping to do it just using, you know, images, but I wasn't able to. But I was able to. The area that I thought I found like some areas using satellite imagery, and I was able to confirm that with people that I know there. So that helps. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on a great thing there, which is, you know, if you're limited on the data, be resourceful, right? Sounds like you used Humint there to actually figure out what the real answer was through your human sources. And it just goes to show you nothing can beat boots on the ground. You know, that really is the best thing. And even with all the data that we can collect from satellite imagery, you know, RGB, thermal, SAR, all that stuff's great. But having someone there that can go verify something, I mean, that's as good as it gets, you know. So your work, so that article, it should be out right now. Is the idea to talk about the Russian defenses that are built up in Crimea, or like what's the angle?
Yeah, so you know, the Ukrainians are saying like they're going to retake Crimea. The Russians are saying like, you know, that Crimea is Russia forever kind of thing, right? And then in the West, you know, there's different things that are being said. The Ukrainians can take it, or they, you know, they can't take it. So what I was thinking about was, you know, what's the reality on the ground, right? The Russians currently control Crimea, but what do the Russians really think? And if the Russians didn't think that Ukraine has a chance of retaking it, then why are they building all these defenses at strategic points, right? So the whole angle was to talk about some of the actions taken by the Ukrainians, you know, in Crimea. You know, there were some attacks on seaports. There were some some actions taken by Ukrainian partisans, you know, sabotaging rail lines and arms depots and things like that. And,
right.
So basically what I've done is mapped out the actions taken by Ukrainians in Crimea and then map out where the Russians are building defenses, showing satellites. This is the location, you know, and basically saying, like, if the Russians didn't think the Ukrainians had a chance, then why are they taking all these precautions, basically?
Yeah, okay. Well, that's an interesting angle and certainly good logic, right?
Yeah.
If they weren't worried about it, then why are they building defenses? I think Crimea would be incredibly difficult for Ukraine to take back at this stage. Maybe in the future, but just based off of the geography, right? This is where it helps to know geography. It's a peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
One way in, one way out, essentially, unless you have a massive navy, which Ukraine doesn't.
Right.
I don't know. That's a tough one. You know, I'd have to look at that and see those details that you're aware of. So I'll look forward to reading that for sure. I'll definitely check that one out.
Yeah, and one of the areas where they're building defenses is like a choke point, like an entry point onto the peninsula.
Right.
And I guess that, like, at the moment, Russia has made some tiny gains in certain areas. But once the ground firms up, I guess that's when the Ukrainians are going to make a counter offensive or counter push. And so I guess it really depends on, you know, how the next couple of months go in the war to determine, you know, how much closer the Ukrainians would get or how much further away they'll get pushed by the Russians. In doing this, I was able to speak to some Ukrainians that I know who are in the special operations groups in Ukraine, and just sort of get their thoughts on it. And they fully believe that they're going to retake Crimea. It's not like I was talking to them on a public platform, and they're just right. trying to say the right thing. Like, they really believe that they will. And obviously that remains to be seen, because if they are able to take it, it's not going to be easy. So we'll see. I guess next few months will really determine how the next steps in the war is going to go. So
yeah, you have to think that Ukraine at some point is starting to think offensively versus defensively, right? At some point, if you can only hold up a shield so long before your arm gets tired. So I think it'd be wise for them to start thinking about this type of... It's easier said than done, man. We're just sitting here talking about it, but that's an incredibly difficult task, and more power to them. Ukraine is really... It's just another quagmire. You know, I think the eastern part of the country is basically doomed to be in conflict for a really long time. And who knows? No end in sight, in my opinion. What do you think? Do you think the United States should, step in?
In terms of, like, sending boots on the ground, or?
Well, I mean, here's a question for you. You know, we've sent $64 billion in funds. I think we're going to send another $7 billion or so. So $70 billion. We've sent javelins. We've sent tanks. We've sent, a lot of, I think it was 10% of our military spending or something, went to Ukraine. At what point does Vladimir Putin say, we're basically at war with the United States?
I think they kind of say that now. And I don't know if they really feel like that or they just say that for, political purposes, to,
because base,
yeah. Yeah. And they really underperformed, I would say, the Russian military.
Big time.
Yeah. So it's like, I guess, from the leadership perspective, it's a balancing act. And they, you know, maybe they don't want to make excuses, but for, if they can say, you know, we're actually fighting against NATO and we're fighting against the U.S., that that makes the difficulty of the fight easier to take for the Russian population. So I think they're already saying it. You know, and I mean, I guess to some extent it is true because they are, you know, they're being, the Ukrainians are being armed and equipped by mostly by America, but also by other NATO nations. And I think, I don't know, maybe in a month or something, something soon, there's going to be, I don't know, 40 or 60,000 Ukrainians who are currently in Europe training in NATO countries. They're going to go back into Ukraine. And I think that's going to be, you know, what they're going to attempt to push with and retake more territory. So, you know, there's a bunch of questions, right? Like, how much should we continue to support them? You know, if this war goes on for 2 or 3 years, are we going to, you know, spend another $200, $300 billion supporting them? And I think it's a fair question to ask. I do believe that Russia made a big mistake in invading. You know, it, one of the things that people in the West say is like, oh, you know, NATO expanded and sort of got too close. And that's why the Russians had to do this. But the reason why I don't believe that is because there are certain criteria that you have to meet to join NATO. And if your country is having an open conflict, you can't join. Like, they won't accept you. And they didn't need to invade the whole country in order to prevent Ukraine from being eligible for NATO because they were fighting in the east. They could have continued to fight, like, a much lower intensity fight in the east, and it would have kept Ukraine out of NATO for years. So... and then also an issue I have, and I don't think people do this purposely in the West, but I think the language of NATO expansion is the way the Russians want people to look at it. And one thing you hear, you know, critics of NATO or people who say that NATO sort of caused this is that the U.S. Made assurances to... I think it was Gorbachev that, you know, NATO wouldn't move an inch towards the east, right? But Gorbachev came out, there's an evidence and information of him saying, like, direct quote, that the U.S. never actually said that. And there was nothing signed by either country that this is the agreement. The you know, supposedly what was said was a verbal agreement, right? So I think... some of that is Russian disinformation, which they are very good at, and you know they've done it for decades. So and then you know one of Putin's objectives, right, was to have a pro-Russian government set up in Ukraine, and to you know air quote stop NATO from growing on Russia's border. But Finland just joined NATO, so he failed on that objective. Ukraine is fiercely resisting; he failed on that objective. And they've had some pretty hard sanctions put on their economy. So I think this was a major, major miscalculation by Putin. Now, obviously, as we talked about before, there's a bunch of maneuvering happening to counter the United States, you know, not just by China, by obviously by Iran and Saudi Arabia. It's looking like they are going to align themselves more towards China, Russia, as opposed to the U.S. You know, there's a bunch of stuff happening to try and weaken the dollar. So things are changing, but I do think regardless of whatever happens, I think the U.S. will be fine. If anyone wants to attack the mainland, they have to cross oceans, and we have the best Navy in the world. So that would be tough for them. You know, on the currency side, right, people talk about, like, the BRICS nation, they want to create a currency that's backed by gold, which the U.S. dollar isn't. But you know, if they do that, one thing people should understand is that the U.S. has the largest gold reserves in the world by a long shot. So if they created a currency backed by something that we have the most of, I don't see how that really hurts the U.S.
Yeah, how does that help?
Yeah.
You want to use a digital currency or something?
Right.
Look, no country on earth is dumb enough to face the United States in a straight-up armed conflict.
Right.
We have the machines. Let's put it that way. The United States is the number one exporter of machines globally. What does that mean? That means we have the best engineers, the best scientists, the best technology. That's why China just steals from us. You don't want to mess with the United States in a straight-up conflict. It's not going to end well for you. We spend more on our military than the next 13 countries combined or something like that. But when you look at Ukraine, you can't blame NATO for Vladimir Putin's actions. I mean, this guy is a dictator. He's a maniacal, old, crazy guy. He thinks he's God. We need to step out of our shoes for a minute and start to think differently, because they don't think the way that we do. You know, they're not thinking about, I'll just work diplomatically with, the United States and these countries, and we'll all get along and everything will be fine. No, their mindset is smash, grab, and take. We're going to smash, grab, and take Ukraine because it's ours. That's the mindset. It's not, we tend to view things from the perspective of a soft Western perspective that doesn't, we don't value aggression anymore. I mean, you could see this culturally, right? You hear things like toxic masculinity. Well, guess what? That masculinity that's so toxic also built the railroads. It also built the infrastructure that powers our cities. It also, guarded us against the Nazis in World War II. But that philosophy is very Russian in nature. It's very, it's the way that they view things. It's strength. There's also some beauty to that as well. You know, anybody that studies Russian literature will tell you that's absolutely beautiful. But it's just a different way of thinking. So I don't agree with these people that want to be apologists that say that, Putin just did this for NATO. Well, forget about that. You know, if you rob a liquor store, it's only the robber's fault. It's not the fault of the store, right? It's not the fault of the store owner or the person behind there. People need to be accountable for their own actions. So I think that's crazy to say, we didn't make him invade Ukraine. And you're right. This was an absolute blunder for Russia. Now we see their military is really not what we thought it was. Their capability is not what we thought it was. One thing we do know is that they still have the philosophy of warfare they had in World War II, which is we're just going to throw more bodies at it than you.
Yeah.
And that's what they're going to do. If we think that they're just going to back off and that, we could send more money over there and tomorrow everything will be fine, that's not what's going to happen. They're just going to send more humans at that border, at the where the conflict zone is right now in Ukraine, until they get their way. So it is a crazy situation. You know, do we just keep sending them money every year? People will say, well, we need to put that money to use here in America. Other perspectives might say, spending a bit of our budget to thwart Russia from becoming, running and taking over countries is a good use of our money. I don't know what the answer is, but I just know that each side has a point, and we have to let things play out. But one thing is for certain is that Russia's to blame. No one else is to blame. That's it. Just Russia, and now we got to deal with them. So that's what it is. But I always say that I don't like to predict the future, but I often do it because it's fun. I just don't see a way out of that situation without either we have to, maybe not boots on the ground, but we can do a lot with airspace. And either we say, screw it, let's do it, and, you know, take over Ukrainian airspace. You know, our biggest thing is always that threat of nuclear warfare, of course, which is a viable threat. But there's got to be a calculation made, which is, you know, how likely are they to use nuclear weapons if we fight back here? It's a quagmire. Like I said, I can't predict the future, but I think if we don't do anything, if we just sit back and let it evolve, you know, there's going to be more death than there would be otherwise. At the same time, I would hate for one American life to be lost in Ukraine that was sent by our government. You know, now somebody wants to grab a rifle and go over there, that's on them, right? That's a free country. You certainly can do that. But for our government to send people over there, you know, that's tough. It's the Wild West, man.
I don't think we should send the American government to send people. Obviously, there are Americans there fighting, and some Americans have been killed in the fighting over there. But I think, you know, I think what would end up happening is both sides are going to try and make as much gains as they can in the next year or so. And then perhaps there'll be some negotiation with both sides trying to, you know, gain a position of strength, you know, for the negotiation. So, like, if Ukraine can take, I don't know, a couple more towns to the east and move the front line closer to the Russian border, then they'll be willing to, you know, negotiate. Mm-hmm. And then, but then the same goes for Russia. And if, you know, they lose some more territory, are they going to want to negotiate? And just recently, European leaders went to China. And I think the French president was trying to lean on Xi Jinping to try and negotiate a settlement in Ukraine. And perhaps, you know, that's what's required, because China is really saving Russia from going under at this point, economically. So, you know, maybe if the Chinese are willing to lean on the Russians a little bit, and then, you know, the U.S. and NATO can kind of lean on Ukraine a little bit, that will lead to an actual settlement. And then maybe that will be the end of fighting. But, you know, we'll see.
Right. I don't think Ukraine gets out of this without surrendering some type of territory. I just don't see how they can, at this point, say, you know, you keep hearing it, not one inch, right? That's what they're saying, not one inch. They're going to have to give up some inches. That's just, in order to reach an agreement, they're going to have to give up some inches. If they don't, they won't reach an agreement, and they'll just continue the war. But it is in our best interest to do this diplomatically. China plays a massive role, like you talked about. But it also takes some level heads to go in and say, you know what, Russia, you took this territory, fine. No more death. Let's stop this right now. And, you know, come up with a more diplomatic solution. Of course, a Ukrainian would listen to me and say, you know, no way, whatever. Yeah. But this is the difference between life and death. You know, do you give up some territory, or do you want your country to be riddled in warfare for the next 30 years, losing your sons and grandsons, or do you want to come up with a solution? So some tough choices have to be made. Some egos have to be checked, and pride needs to be swallowed, and recognize that, you know, shit's not going to be perfect. It's just not. So, you know, what do you think? What do you think is the most likely way for it to come to a conclusion? Because one thing's for sure is that all things come to an end.
Right. I think we'll have to see how the next like 5 or 6 months go. If the Ukrainians can make a sort of large push, and I mean, like, who knows? Because they, I think it was back in, I don't know if it was, I think it was November, maybe October or November or September, some in that time frame, they retook thousands of kilometers of territory back. It was kind of a shocking event. Now, I don't know if they can do that again. You know, they kind of tricked the Russians with their maneuvering. I don't know if, you know, the same trick would work twice or, you know.
Right.
So, like, you know, let's say they're able to take a bunch of territory again in their sort of counteroffensive. Then perhaps they may say, you know what, we're going to keep fighting until we push them back completely. You know, if they push and take a little bit, but, they, you know, they can't seem to get past certain points. Then maybe that's where the negotiations begin. But I think it would have to be some kind of negotiation unless Ukraine absolutely mops the floor with the Russians in the next, you know, 6 months or so. And like from, like I've known people in Ukraine for like over 10 years, like way before, any of this war was happening. And since the war has begun, I've made more friends and I know people, Westerners who are there and Ukrainian special ops guys I have relationships with, and they are 100% committed, to pushing Russia out. And like, the, like all the stuff that you see Zelensky saying, like they believe it, you know, word for word.
Right. As a fighter, you should.
Right.
Like that's as a fighter, you need to be all in on the mission. But these things don't get resolved by fighters; they get resolved by diplomats.
Right.
And that's what's gonna, at the end of the day, that's what's gonna happen. Have you seen that? There's a movie on Netflix recently, which I just think is really poignant right now. It's called All Quiet on the Western Front. Have you seen this movie?
No. People have been telling me to watch it. A friend of mine, okay, he read the book years ago, and he told me it was one of the best books he's ever read.
Okay. I won't spoil the movie. It's a fantastic movie, but I recommend everybody watch it if you're interested in this type of thing. But the basis of the movie is, you know, without giving away the ending and all that stuff, is that there's massive, you know, humans aren't perfect, and there's egos that go into making these types of decisions. Like it does revolve around, you know, a peace deal after World War I. And it just goes to show that, you know, the consequences of ego essentially, and how that plays out in warfare. You know, if the people making the decisions, and, you know, generals and diplomats and things like this at those levels, if they don't swallow their ego, people die. And there's real consequences to not approaching things diplomatically and recognizing that, the reality on the ground of what's happening. Right. So I think it's a really poignant movie. Came at the perfect time. It's on Netflix. Definitely check that one out. You'll enjoy it. I did. That's for sure.
Yeah. I've heard nothing but good things about it. And I know the book is a very, like, you know, widely respected book. And so, you know, good book, good movie. I'm definitely going to check it out. You know, I've had it on my watch list for a while, but I just haven't gotten around to it.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So it was great to do this. You know, like I said, I've been sort of following you guys for years, and I've heard good things about you guys from people that I respect. Yep. And so it was great to talk to you, and you know, sort of recently, just taking a you know, dipping my toes in the geospatial, you know, pond, if you will, made me very fascinated in it. And so I'm really happy to talk to you. If anyone in the audience wants to keep up with you guys or just follow what you got going on, where can they do that?
Well, hopefully you can put some links in the description on the podcast platform. So definitely check out the description. If you go to geoowl.com, that's my company. If you go to ndsshow.com, that's the podcast. But look, no, I really appreciate you having me. I know you brought me on to talk about geospatial intelligence and you went off on China and Ukraine and all these things. But, you know, I'll just leave people with this concept, which is that, you know, intelligence is really a fantastic career field. It's the people in the intelligence community really care about this country. We really care about providing the right answers. We don't want to be political, though obviously it does become political at times, you know, in the news and things like that. The intelligence community is all about doing the right thing and providing good data so people can make good decisions. And that's what we aim to do at GOL. And that's always been the rule of thumb for our values as a company. So I really appreciate you having me. And yeah, I really hope people can take a minute to check out the links in the description and head over to YouTube as well and maybe check out some of the stuff I got going on there.